Hello, welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick here. Should Indigenous prisoners who create paintings in a prison art studio be able to sell those artworks and pocket the proceeds? Two art exhibitions, one in Melbourne and the other in Brisbane, highlight the dramatically different approaches taken around the country. That's later in the program. For the first time, Australia has a female Chief Justice. On Monday, in an impressive ceremony at the High Court of Australia in Canberra, Susan Kiefel was sworn in as the nation's top judge.
When I came to the bar in 1975, there were very few women members of the profession. This is not the occasion to consider why this was so. The point presently to be made is that this has changed, and so has the composition of this court.
Although the speeches were dignified and subdued, there was a palpable sense of celebration and history in the courtroom. Dr. Heather Roberts is a senior lecturer at the Australian National University. She attended the swearing-in.
The courtroom was full of distinguished women lawyers, and you could see also the future generation for women in the law, with the associates seated behind the judges on the court. Of the 11 associates there, six were women. So a very different gender picture today from what we could imagine happened 30 years ago with the swearing in of the first woman of the court, Mary Gaudron.
So this is, of course, a historic moment in time. Australia has its first female Chief Justice. How was this acknowledged in the speeches?
In many different ways. The Attorney General, as perhaps we might have expected from the way he announced the appointment of Susan Kiefel, placed great emphasis on the fact that she is an extraordinary judge with an unusual background, and her story is one of inspiration for both men and women. This was the starting point for his speech. He then went on to emphasise the historic first for women. That was very different to the second speaker welcoming the new Chief Justice, Fiona McLeod, President of the Law Council of Australia, who framed her speech to signify the great importance of the event for women in the law in Australia, for marking the fact that we have a first female Chief Justice. And noting also that the ceremony started with a dramatic visual difference for women. The fact that our new female Chief Justice took her oath of office and allegiance from another female justice, Justice Virginia Bell.
How about Susan Kiefel herself? How did her speech address this momentous occasion?
Her speech was one of emphasising the extraordinary importance of the role of the Chief Justice within the Australian legal system. And she also acknowledged, of course, that when she was appointed as a Queen's Counsel in Queensland, she was the first woman to that role, and the landscape for women was very different. But her speech was one of emphasising that for women of talent, the pathway through the judiciary was available to them.
Now, of course, she's remarkable for a number of reasons, not least being that she left school at age 15 and she worked as a legal secretary and then completed high school part-time. And then instead of studying law at university, which is sort of the traditional way of getting your degree, she studied law in the evening through the barrister's board system. So she really has an unusual and quite inspirational journey.
She definitely does. The last time a High Court judge took this pathway into the law was 1987 with Justice Michael McHugh. And it's an incredible story. I think particularly it was a wonderful coincidence that the news of her appointment came out just as Year 12 students were getting their university results. So any that might have been disheartened that they couldn't get into law straight away need only to look to the example of Susan Kiefel to see that there are other pathways to success in the law.
Heather Roberts, it's a smashing of the glass ceiling in a very profound way. Was there a sense of, you know, muted, dignified, nevertheless, but sense of celebration and a sense of extraordinary moment in history?
Definitely, Damien. The assembled audience, particularly after the ceremony, there was a real buzz in the High Court in a very positive sense of what this moment means for the Australian legal community and women in law. Fiona McLeod's speech, this was a very prominent theme, more muted certainly from the Attorney General, but we could be left with no doubt that everyone in the room recognised that history was being made.
Now, Susan Kiefel has been a member of the High Court since 2007. From the way that she has carried out her role so far on the bench. What can we tell about the way she might carry out her role as Chief Justice?
That's a fabulous question, Damien. We do have to be a little bit careful because we've had Chief Justices in the past who have somewhat surprised us in how they've transformed from being a Justice to being a Chief Justice. Chief Justice Mason is a notable example. But one of the key themes in her swearing-in speeches and in the welcomes today was the importance of collegiality in the way Susan Kiefel approaches her role and how she views the court as a collegiate institution. So based on her past decisions and what she said at her swearing-in, we can expect a court that will work towards joint judgments where it's possible and also recognise that, of course, individual judges need to write their own decisions when they disagree or have a different perspective.
Susan Kiefel's appointment is, of course, momentous, but it was in no way a surprise, was it?
No, I don't think we can say it was a surprise. She was the most senior judge on the court at the time of the retirement of Chief Justice French, and it's a tradition in Australia, although by no means required, that a new Chief Justice will be selected either from the most senior judge currently sitting on the bench or taken from outside. Susan Kiefel's record on the High Court was one that is greatly respected. Prior to her elevation as Chief, she has extraordinary judicial experience, so it certainly wasn't a surprise, but that does not make it any less welcome.
Absolutely. It's a historic day. Now, rather lost in the excitement was the swearing in of the newest member of the court, Justice James Edelman, in the afternoon. He's a bit of a wunderkind, isn't he?
He's certainly been described as a precocious intellect. He's one of the youngest judges of the High Court. You have to look back to judges born in the 1880s to find any younger judge appointed to the court.
How old is he? Is he the early 40s, right?
He is, that's right, for 43 years old. He's just pipped at the post for the second youngest judge by Sir Owen Dixon, one of Australia's most notable judges.
So if the age of retirement is age 70, that means he's going to be around for a long time on the High Court. So he's a likely future Chief Justice. Can we go that far?
I think just by the length of time that he'll be on the court, he would definitely be a likely candidate for a Chief Justiceship. And that was the path, of course, that Sir Owen Dixon took when he was appointed. He was appointed very young and was ultimately a very famous Chief Justice of Australia.
Heather Roberts, final question. On a personal level, what did you take from yesterday's big events?
It was extraordinary to see Australia's first female justice sworn in. It's such a significant event and a milestone for Australian society to recognise that women are performing these key public roles. What was so interesting contrasting the two ceremonies that happened yesterday, Damien, was to see the different ways in which women in law are welcomed, but also perhaps a changing perspective on the importance of having broad diversity in the courts, diversity not just in gender, but also diversity in age of the people who are deciding our key legal disputes. Justice Edelman is a judge born in the 1970s.
Heather Roberts, thanks so much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks very much, Damien.
Dr. Heather Roberts, Senior Lecturer at the Australian National University. You're listening to the Law Report on ABC RN. I'm Damien Carrick. In Victoria, at the Art Gallery at St Kilda Town Hall, there's an exhibition called Confined Eight, which is organised by Kent Morris. He's the CEO of a group called The Torch, an organisation that works with Indigenous prisoners in 12 jails across the state. I visited the exhibition as it was being installed and spoke to Kent as well as some of the artists featured in the exhibition. G'day Mark, how are you going?
Yep, pretty good.
We're currently sitting in St Kilda Town Hall Art Gallery. Now you're Mark Wise, you're one of the artists who are exhibiting your work here at the exhibition. Well, I'm just looking across at a beautiful canvas that you've got against the wall.
Yeah, this one, I call it Life.
So to describe it for people, it's about a metre across and about 60, 70 centimetres tall, and And it's a beautiful brown snake, and there are some blue circles, eggs, and there are also some hands, if you like, around the edge of the snake, kind of pushing it into the middle of the canvas. It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah, it's about a brown snake which is having eggs for future, and the hands represent putting the snake into position.
About hope, is it?
It's about hope, and what else you could put guidance in there as well. That took me about 2 weeks, because when I paint, the spirit just comes to me. Sometimes I don't even know what I'm painting. Sometimes, like, I'll look at it and I'll think, did I just do that, you know? Like, yeah, and I love that feeling, you know? It's a good culture feeling, yeah. Spiritually, yeah.
Kent Morris, we're standing in St Kilda Town Hall Art Gallery. Tell me about the Confined 8 exhibition. Who are the participants?
Well, this year there are 145 participants from the Torches Indigenous Arts in Prisons and Community program, and these are men and women who've engaged with the program across the 12 prisons in Victoria, and those who, upon release from prison, is connected to the post-release program. But Confined is a chance for the program and the men and women in the program to share their stories and to, I guess, express how important AO art and culture is, and particularly on the road back to rehabilitation and reintegration.
The artwork is all about culture and Indigenous identity, and so on one wall I think we've got a series of paintings which are about country, I think. On the other wall behind us, we've got a series of paintings. The theme is birds. Down the other part of the room, I can see a wall with fish or underwater themes.
When I started this program and I asked the men and women in the prisons what would they want from a program of this nature, no one said to me, we want to learn more about paint and mixing colours or drawing. Everyone uniformly said questions like, I want to need to know my totem animal. Can you help me learn my language? I'm not sure about my family history, or I need to see you connect to my country. What are the creation stories? You know, these were the questions. They're all cultural identity questions. And so the strengthening around that area is where we focus. Through that process is in the creation of art. So a cultural production practice is really important. And through it, we're doing painting mainly. And through that process is learning, but also the healing comes in that process as well. So that upon release, the men and women are more able to navigate difficult circumstances or make better decisions. And with the new policy of being able to sell artworks, there's also a sense of economic independence and of empowerment, which has led to men and women more often than not going into employment for the first time, or pursuing higher education, or, as for some of the artists are doing, pursuing a career in the art.
I'm Fitzroy where the stars be. I'm Wanganeen in 93. I'm Mundine, I'm Kathy Free. Man, that far inside of me. I'm Adam Goods, and Adam should be applauded when he stands up. He can look
to Mark, where did you learn to paint? Did you learn to paint in jail?
Yeah, I first learned how to paint in jail. You say about 3 or 4 years ago, I wasn't even painting. I wouldn't even know how to paint, you know. And I don't know, if you get to a certain age, you know, I'm 41 years old now, and you get to a certain age where the parties are over and it's time to get serious about life and who you are inside, and your Aboriginality, and never be shame of your culture, and, you know, because I used to be like that. I used to be shame of my culture, you know, because I'm a stolen part of the stolen generation kind of a thing. I was fostered out, you know, and taken away from my family, and I didn't know nothing about my culture. And but now it's just all coming. It's kind of me hitting me, you know, strongly, spiritually, you know, yeah.
And so you're part of the stolen generation, and you spent time in jail. Have you spent a lot of time in jail over the years?
Yeah, I was drinking. I'd be stealing cars, you know, and stealing from the shops, but mostly violence, you know, and drunk rampage violence and family violence, you know.
When you started with the Torch program, do you think that's made a difference?
Like they say, you know, there's a reason for everything, you know, in life, and it might sound funny, but maybe it might have been the way it went through jail to get to know how to paint my culture. You know what I mean? It's just weird, but, and there's no more jail for me, I guarantee you. I got out of straight release this time, so there's no more jail there, you know what I mean? So now it's just going to be full-on painting now.
When did you get out of jail?
Oh, I just got out like last year now, November, yeah, straight release. So now it's to cut that cycle now. I'm everything that you are, I'm everything that you come.
I'm the dead heart, heartbeat. I'm the dead heart.
Is this art therapy? I mean, are you seeking behaviour change by people expressing themselves through art? Is that what we're talking about here?
That's part of it. So we're looking at absolutely trying to break patterns of behaviour or change patterns of behaviour and that ability to make better decisions. One thing the evaluation showed was that behaviour changed significantly within the prison for participants of the program. So their behavioural change became due to connection to the program, and this involved steering away from negative behaviours within the prison. One of the real surprises for me was connectivity to other programs that the participants hadn't connected to before, around drug and alcohol misuse, around parenting, around violence. Now, prisons were quite amazed and very happy, of course, that men and women were connecting to the programs they hadn't connected to before. And I thought about it long and hard and talked to the fellows, and they felt that because the Torch program had so much respect for culture and for who they were and to build that sense of identity, they then felt empowered and strong enough to take on some of the issues that were the cause of their offending behaviour and go and address them through program. But of course, the challenge is then to maintain that.
G'day, Jacko. Look, thanks for talking to the Law Report. You're an artist. You've had works in this exhibition in previous years.
Yeah, I've had a few works in the Torch before, yeah.
So did you participate in the Torch program in jail? Did you kind of spend time in the studio painting?
Yeah, we got our own art room in there where we always go down and paint twice a week. But we can open the room up if there's nothing else to do, then they'll normally open it up an extra day for us, you know. Just takes you away from jail for the day. It's like you're not even in jail, you know. You got your curry music playing, you got your paints out, and you just go in the zone.
Why were you sentenced to jail?
Just family.
Family violence.
Domestics and that.
So you've actually sold work, haven't you?
Yeah, I've sold a few.
Do you rely on the income that from painting, or is it just something which is a few extra dollars here and there?
It helps out a lot. Because I've got six kids, helps out a lot, you know.
And there's a lot of idea that somehow this kind of arms people with the ability for self-expression and to kind of articulate their ideas about themselves and about their country and about their people, and maybe that'll help them not re-offend. I mean, do you see that as a kind of a something which happens?
Yeah, well, I know of a few blokes that it's been pretty successful for. A few of them, you know, they've been out of jail for over 2 years, you know, now. Yeah, so it does help a lot of people.
Jacko, thank you very much for talking to me.
Yep, no worries.
Beautiful artworks around here. Kent, what's the price range?
Well, the good news is there's something for everybody. So the prices might start around about $150 to $200 and they escalate up to some of the, you know, in the higher level range. There are a few works in the $4,500 range for exceptional works by very experienced artists, which are extraordinary.
So what's the situation? How is art produced in prisons regulated? So can a prisoner sell their work and keep the money in Victoria? How does it work both in Victoria and around the country?
Okay, so fortunately last year the Victorian government produced the what's called the Aboriginal Arts Policy Model, and that allows Indigenous men and women who are connected to the Torch program to sell their works whilst they're incarcerated. So it's quite groundbreaking. 100% of the money from those sales are held in trust so that the artist can access that money upon release. What's also really important is that any interest on that entire trust fund is paid to a victims of crime fund, and that also the families on the outside can apply to have money released to for specific circumstances, particularly when it revolves educational needs for children and other possible health concerns that are impacting on that household's ability to not slip further into disadvantage.
Tell me about some of the people who've emerged from jail and then had this money sitting in the trust fund. How much money are we talking about? And then what kind of impact having that money sitting there has had for them?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of stories. And again, the range of money is often not the amount that it's important. It's what that fella might do with it. So he was incarcerated. Upon his release, he faced a similar circumstance that many do, an inability to find affordable accommodation, somewhere to live. So he really went back to a family situation where there was misuse of alcohol, and he had issues with alcohol that he wanted to address. Fortunately, the Victorian Ombudsman's Office bought 15 paintings from the program for their new building. Sid's was one of them, and now it was a $750 painting, I believe, around that price point. It was enough for Sid to make a decision to say he was going to move away from where issues were. There's still a lot of hurdles for men and women who are Indigenous and are ex-offenders. There's a painting here that says some fences remain even when we get out. So he found it hard. He didn't give up. And he still had some of that money in his pocket. They went to South Australia. And now, fortunately, they were able to find stable accommodation. And I rang recently, Sid, to see if he would have a painting for this year's exhibition. And he said to me, oh, I have no time, brother. I've enrolled in Adelaide University and I'm doing a music degree. So he not only changed his circumstances, he only, look, really had $750 in his pocket to make this happen from the painting he'd sold. The second story is about a fellow named Ray who's recently been released. Fortunately, last year at the Confined Seven exhibition, we were able to sell Ray's paintings, which are extraordinary. And on the back of that, he now has around about $10,000 to $11,000, which he generated to find a way to set himself up, to not be homeless, to not be trying to find places to live in that would possibly lead him back to where he'd come from, but to find his own way, to empower, he's empowered himself to then navigate his future.
Mark, how much is your beautiful painting over there, how much is that going for? Have you made any money from your painting?
I haven't. This is my first painting now that's in the gallery. But I sold a couple up in Swan Hill to friends and that. But I'm probably the first, I got to say this, the first person out of my family, the Wise family, that's got a patent in the gallery. You know what I mean? Yeah, that spins me out as well, you know. Instead of my name in a jail, in a courthouse list, always, you know what I mean? Like, in the wrong way of putting your name somewhere, breaking the law and stuff, you know. I put my name up somewhere else. Good now, yeah. I've come a long way, I reckon. And it's no turning back. There's no looking back, you know what I mean? There's no walking backwards. You got to keep walking forward, you know what I mean? I'm marching, I'm going, I'm marching, yeah, I'm going, I'm marching, I'm going, I'm
marching, I'm going. Mark Wise, artist and former prisoner. The Torch is planning to expand its operations across Australia. Now, while it is possible in Victoria to sell art by Indigenous prisoners, across the country, the rules vary dramatically. In most jurisdictions, the situation it's woolly, it's open to interpretation and quite ad hoc. Some prison work is certainly sold to the public, especially in New South Wales. But at the far end of the spectrum is Queensland, which has legislation explicitly prohibiting prisoners from profiting from their artwork. Robert Henderson is an Indigenous artist and he's also the owner of the Henderson Gallery in Brisbane.
Currently, Damien, the legislation says that whilst prisoners are incarcerated, they're unable to run a business with any proceeds coming from sales of art or anything else they make in there. There are some caveats to that where artists can donate pieces to nominated charities.
When were the laws changed? Because I understand they weren't always that draconian.
No, legislation was changed. There was a public outcry around a perception of, you know, businesses being run from inside around art. And so the clamps were put on that very quickly.
So the rationale for these tough laws was that you didn't want prisoners to be profiting, making money while they were behind bars.
Yeah, and look, and you know, I get it. It's reasonable. If you have limited information, it's a reasonable assumption to make, but I think that's probably the danger in it.
Now, at your gallery in Brisbane, you currently have an exhibition of art by prisoners, both former prisoners and current prisoners. Tell me about that exhibition. What's in it?
We're very excited about it. We've got works ranging from... Our earliest piece was produced in Bogger Road in 1975 by a First Nations inmate and artist. And the media used is, you know, cigarette ash, charcoal from burnt matches, a couple of HB pencils on paper. So it's a really important piece. We've been loaned that by Uncle Ken Dalton just recently.
So there are some works in the exhibition by currently serving prisoners. Mm. Now, how do you get around the laws in terms of how you display the work?
It's easy enough for us. We don't charge admission.
So you're not actually selling the work by the current prisoners?
No, we can't. It's just not available. We have the opportunity to make a bit of a statement because we also have one young fellow, a former prisoner that we're working with, who's currently on parole, his works are there and are for sale. So it's, you know, you've got fantastic pieces right next to each other. One set are unavailable and the other set is available because of the young fellow's now on parole rather than incarcerated.
And I understand the laws are so tight that you can't even name the currently serving prisoner who is an artist.
No, that's, and yeah, that's, an, I mean, the laws are tight.
I understand you don't think it's realistic to be able to change the law, but you are trying to kind of enter into a dialogue with Queensland authorities. What kind of arrangement are you trying to make with them?
Well, Damien, what we're aiming at is we're really aiming for the lowest common denominator, which we feel is reasonable, which is establishing a trust fund in the primary instance for the funds to go to transport to and from facilities for prisoners to attend funerals. Hopefully it's not particularly arguable that, you know, that people shouldn't have the ability to attend the service of their loved ones.
So at the moment, who pays when a prisoner requests to go to the funeral of, say, their mum or their dad or their kids or their siblings?
Yeah, look, Woodford actually does pay for transport. It's a limited range. My understanding is that range is something around 180k.
Yeah, and of course Queensland is an enormous place, so people are going to be incarcerated in one part of the state, and the cost of getting to the other side of the state or further north is going to be prohibitive, isn't it?
As I understand it, we're looking at around about $2,500 minimum, and that includes two security personnel and the transport to and from. You know, when the distances get up further, it's going to be exceedingly more expensive. But that's not to say that there can't be an opportunity. If they can't travel, perhaps they could contribute to the coffin, or perhaps they could contribute to the costs, whatever it is, some flowers, headstone. You know, we're not suggesting that every single time somebody has to be transported, but, you know, we do advocate that, if possible, that that should happen.
In Queensland, there's no political will, as you see it, to overturn the legislation, but you reckon that the authorities might consider bending the rules to allow certain changes, certain, you know, first of all, funerals, but then maybe keeping the money in trust for actually prisoners to keep once they're released or to give to their families more immediately.
Yeah, look, they're open to the conversation and to the concept. I think I haven't found anybody in my conversations. We've, you know, had quite a number and at top level who have said that this legislation's useful. Again, I understand where it comes from, but it doesn't come from a space of progressive thinking or strategy around what's the best way to deal with the people that we've got inside.
Robert Henderson, Indigenous artist and owner of the Henderson Gallery in Brisbane. That's the Law Report for this week. At our website, you'll find links to both art exhibitions we've been speaking about today. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to technical producer this week, Angie Grant. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.